So my guest today, Scott Barry Kaufman, has a PhD from Yale, an MPhil from Cambridge, and now teaches at Barnard. That's not too shabby for a kid who is labeled as lesser than, put into special education, and told he didn't have the intelligence to really achieve anything meaningful in school or life. And all it took was a single moment in ninth grade where a teacher of his took note of his kind of innate curiosity and abilities and prompted him to reclaim control over his education and eventually life. In that moment, everything changed. Now he is an acclaimed psychologist, researcher, professor. He embraces a kind of a humanistic, integrative approach that really takes into account a wide range of human variation, from learning disabilities to intellectual and creative giftedness to introversion, narcissism, and something he calls twice exceptionality, all in the name of helping all kinds of minds live a more creative, more fulfilling, more meaningful life. Scott also writes the weekly Beautiful Minds column for Scientific American. He hosts the Psychology Podcast, which is awesome. You should check it out. He writes, his books include Ungifted and Wired to Create, two awesome reads. And lately, he's been taking a serious deep dive into self-actualization and transcendence, getting rare access to Maslow's published and private writing that has fueled his own research and identified the key elements of what it takes to really step more fully into the experience of life. Super excited to share this wide-ranging and eye-opening conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good Life Project is brought to you by Understood Explains, a podcast that's like a beacon for parents navigating the special education system. Hosted by Juliana Urtubey, a special education expert, this season is all about individualized education plans, or IEPs. Juliana breaks down complex topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP in a way that's easy to grasp. I checked out an episode of Understood Explains about the difference between IEPs and 504 plans, and I was struck by the balance of empathy and practical advice. It's not just about understanding the system. It's about empowering parents and caregivers to advocate for their children, which is just so important. So I've known a number of people who've had to literally scramble to figure out how to advocate for their kids when the system seemed to just make it so hard to get the support that they need and deserve. So if you're a parent navigating this world, or even just wondering if it's right for your family, I encourage you to give Understood Explains a listen. Search for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. It's like having a roadmap for a journey you didn't expect, making it a little less daunting. Good Life Project is sponsored by LinkedIn Ads. So as a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long, and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. So isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions tailored for B2B. Imagine having direct access to a billion professionals, including 180 million senior executives and 10 million C-level leaders. With LinkedIn's powerful targeting tools built for B2B, you can drive serious results. LinkedIn ads generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social platforms in the technology space. We've actually tapped the power of LinkedIn ads a number of times ourselves, and the campaigns have been really successful. If you're ready to revolutionize your B2B marketing, try LinkedIn ads with a $100 credit on your next campaign. Terms and conditions apply. Go to linkedin.com/goodlifeproject to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/goodlifeproject, or just click the link in the show notes. Terms and conditions apply. Incredibly accomplished by all possible sort of like ways people might describe you from the outside in. The word intelligent is going to creep into the conversation. Yet, if we take a big step back in time, when you were a little kid, your experience of the way that people sort of treated you was very different.
Yeah, it's very surreal to me when people say that, like, you're brilliant. Or, I'm not saying like everyone says that, but I'm saying whenever someone says you're smart or whatever, it's very, very surreal to me to hear that, because it definitely was not part of my self schema growing up. So kind of like was hard for me to transition to adulthood, where that was like an adjective, like people were actually perceiving that, and I didn't have to like work hard for people to perceive it that way, if that makes sense. Like I spent a lot of my early childhood trying to kind of prove myself, trying to feel like I had to prove it because I had a label of a learning disability called central auditory processing disorder.
What is that? How did that manifest?
What it did is it made it like a little bit slower for me to process auditory input. So what I would do, and I don't know what it's like to be a normal human being, but for me, like growing up as an early child, like I would hear a stream of input and then I would replay it in my head and then I would kind of like download it and then process it later. You know, it's like I didn't have this kind of real time processing of auditory input. And that was the result. You know, I was, well, you probably don't know, but I was essentially deaf the first couple years of my life with ear infections. So they say like when you're blind and they do an operation for you not to be blind anymore, you don't see all of a sudden. You have to learn how to see. So when they did the operation, they put in tubes, everything at age 3 or I think it was, or 4. It's not like I automatically could hear or know what I was, how to process input. So that was a result of that. So yeah, it's to this day, it's like fascinating to me when if people perceive me as intelligent, I'm like, wow, I don't even have to like work hard to prove that anymore. I can just, can I calm down of finally, you know?
I mean, it was so interesting because so much of that type of identity we step into it at such a young age, and yeah, no matter what happens, no matter how much we accomplish in the world, it follows us for so long.
It really does.
So you're, as a young kid, you're experiencing things as, I mean, it's so interesting the way you described it too, which is you would hear it, but you wouldn't really process or integrate it. But it was almost like it was downloaded into your brain and you could work through it later. Did you find that, I don't know if you can answer this, when you would sort of revisit it and say, okay, so let me actually digest this, were you playing it at a slower speed? Was it, how, do you have any sense for how you were actually doing that?
Well, you know, I think that I did have a certain intelligence that gave me a compensatory advantage, as we say in the field, you know. So I think intelligence can be a protective factor for some learning disabilities. And now looking back at my life, and especially now I study what are called twice exceptional children, and we can talk about that because that's a big part of my research interest these days. I think that I was twice exceptional by that definition, in the sense that I had this working memory capacity where I could hold that auditory input in my head and then really, really quickly process it. So eventually I got to the point, and even to today, I don't know what it's like to be a normal human being. So I don't know. Maybe even today, I'm not really in real time hearing you. Like maybe I'm playing the tape in my head really quickly, but it's almost imperceptible now. Like you wouldn't, like, would you talk to me and say, well, boy, he really has a central auditory processing disorder?
Yeah.
Like, no, maybe you did. You just being nice.
No. So it's interesting. So it's almost like it's still there, but your experience of it is the gap between the time where it goes in and you're sort of processing it has narrowed dramatically.
Yeah. It compensates so quickly and efficiently after so many years of this. I think this is just something that we underestimate in anyone who has suffering or going uphill battle in a certain area in which they need to be resilient. I mean, we can learn all sorts of strategies that really can take us to the same eventual outcome.
Yeah. So when you're a little kid and you're grappling with this, how did that show up in the way that you have to go to school, obviously, and so you're in this learning environment, which is very traditional and very sort of, it is the way it is. So how does that show up in your life in the context of your early education, you as a young kid?
Well, it showed up in the sense that I retreated into an inner world of fantasy and imagination. I really detached from the regular classroom. And you know, the one word that I have all these things saved, like all these like teacher reports when I was a kid, and they all would say, he's really, really creative. And there was always a but after that, you know, it was always like, it wasn't like, you know, wow, he's really creative, period. It was like every single one was like, yeah, he's really, really imaginative, but he needs to learn how to behave. Like he needs to learn how to. But like, yeah, he came in the other day when I was trying to read to the classroom and he ran around in a Superman cape. Okay, yeah, I understand that's not normal childhood behavior, but can you build off that at all? And I mean, I was really bored as well. Just the traditional sort of model of education of like, you know, just sit in your seat and pay attention. That was just never for me. But it was always viewed as a very negative thing. Like whenever I tried to I wrote stories, really elaborate, creative. I was really into creative writing. So to answer your question, one concrete way it manifests itself was through a lot of creative writing. My mom has it all, has it saved, but that was viewed as like bad behavior pretty much.
So, I mean, it's sort of like you're trying to fit into the box of what is education, traditional school, and it's just not working.
Yeah.
So how did they deal with it? I mean, how did the teachers deal with you?
Well, they put me in special education. And gave me even more remedial classes. You know, that's like, that was my punishment for not behaving and being anxious as well. So another issue is that I had a lot of anxiety. Mostly I started to develop it's rocket science, right? I developed the anxiety once they put me in special education and told me that I was not capable of the regular course load. So that gave me anxiety. And then that they said, well, we need to like give him double remediation because he's anxious. So it's like, you know, this stuff really creates a cycle for a lot of these kids. And I saw that firsthand, but I also, as a kid, was like, wow, I really want to change this someday.
Yeah. I mean, and also on the level of identity, it creates a label.
You know,
it's like something that you step into where... Yeah. And especially at that age, you know, it's not necessarily seen as something where, well, this is their label. This is the way that they need to sort of put me in the box they need to put me in. But this is not necessarily me. And it's not necessarily, and also just the way I'm experiencing things is not for life. Like this is a moment in time. So how do things start to change?
Well, there was a teacher in ninth grade. I was kept in special ed till ninth grade, but there was a special ed teacher who was covering for the regular teacher. And I was sitting there one day taking an untimed history test. You are removed from the regular classroom and you go to the special resource room to take an untimed test. And I remember being really bored with this test and thinking if it's untimed, I have the rest of my life to finish it. So what's the point? And she was looking at me very curiously, and she took me aside after class, and she's like, you know, why are you still here? Like, you know, I don't really do this with a lot of students, but it just seems like you really don't belong here. And I realized she's the first person to ever ask me that question. So I was like, huh, like, yeah, why am I here? It quickly turned into, why am I here? I got started to get fired up, you know, and I told my parents, you know, I'm going to take myself out of special ed. I'm going to see what I'm capable of. Like she really empowered me just by even asking me that question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and even because the question implies a sense of agency, like you actually, part of the reason you're here is up to you.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like no one's ever broken out of special ed before at my school district. So Kobe Bryant tried, but I'm just joking. He did go to the school at the same time as me. But
so what do your parents say when you go home and you're like, because were your parents just assuming like, well, okay, like they know best. This is the track that's best supporting him in his education.
They supported me for sure. I think they always were very well-meaning and trying to do what was best. My mom always wanted to do what's best for me. She also was a very overprotective mother, Jewish mother, you know, like very overprotective. And just erred too much on the side of caution, you know, and sometimes with kids, you gotta like let them fail, you know, let them see what they're capable of. So I was excited to see what I was capable of. And they were supportive of that decision.
Yeah. So then what do you do with that? I mean, you're 9 years old. This teacher has just challenged.
Well, it's ninth grade. Actually, literally high school.
Got it.
Yeah. I was in special ed till high school. I wasn't college bound, you know, like that wasn't the trajectory that I was on at all. So,
and somewhere in the middle there too, because I mean, so by ninth grade, I'm trying to remember with my kid, like there are at some point, they also like a lot of schools make this split, you know, like the quote gifted and talented track.
Right.
And then you have the sort of like in the middle track and then, and then probably on the other spectrum, at least the way they would put it is learning challenged or special ed. So there's also like the opposite end here, which is the quote gifted and talented or the ones who are labeled gifted and talented. And very often that's based on a single test.
Yeah. The thing that was frustrating for me is that they ask you like what courses you want to take once you get in high school. They don't do that in middle school, but in high school they ask you. And I remember saying, I would really like to, I really like biology. I would like to take a gifted biology class. And they said, no, you can't. You definitely can't do that. You're not capable of that. But the torture was that the resource room where I had to go to take all the untimed tests was right across the hall from the advanced biology freshman class. So it was like torture for me because like and that's really where I wanted to be. And I think that special ed teacher really picked up on that. You know, God bless her.
Yeah. So it's ninth grade. You've got this new challenge set for you. You've got the rest of high school to do something different.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
I really made a change. Like I signed up for summer classes. So right after freshman year, that summer, taking all sorts of classes to try to catch up. During that history summer class, I overheard a young lady talk about how the school orchestra, she was like a violinist in the school orchestra, and she's talking about how awesome it is, how they travel the world and they do all sorts of things. And a light bulb went off in my head, and literally right after that class, I walked right to the orchestra conductor's room. He was the orchestra room. He was alone in there tuning a violin. I just went right in there. I was like, "Hey, my name's Scott, and I'd like to sign up for the school orchestra in the fall." I don't know what it was called in high school. I don't know if it was fall, but you know, when school starts up again, he's like, "Hello, like let you in," you know. And he's like, "What do you play?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't play anything yet, but I'll play cello by the start," you know. And he's like, "You know, people have been playing since, you know, elementary school." He's like, "Who's your teacher?" You know, I said Harry Gordetzer, and he said, "Okay, sign up." Harry Gordetzer happened to be my grandfather, and was a famous cellist with the Philadelphia Orchestra, and I knew that I was determined to learn from him, and I actually signed up for the orchestra with him before I even asked my granddad if he would teach me. But I knew that my granddad would love it. He was retired at that point, and my grandmom had always been like, "Please, you know, have him teach you cello." So I went to after school to my granddad. I was like, "Hey, will you teach me to play cello this summer? I want to join the school orchestra." And he was delighted. And I must have practiced eight hours a day, and then 8-9 hours. Then in school, that first semester that I was out of special ed and I was in the orchestra, was the most exhilarating feeling to be in the orchestra. And when they were all tuning that A string, I remember, my gosh, this is the first time I've ever been in a room. It dawned on me. It was the first time I've ever been in a room where there were high expectations for everyone in that room. You know, and I didn't know what that felt like to have high expectations, you know, because I was so used to having this label and, you know, and being remediated and everything as well. Everything was always about like, "Oh, well, let's make sure Scotty can handle it. I'm done with the coddling. Like the next person that calls me, I'm going to punch him."
So, I mean, was
you know what I mean?
Right. I mean, it's interesting. Like that was the moment for you.
Yeah.
Where you like there was an awakening. Like, okay.
It was awakening. Like yeah. You can't imagine. I mean, I can't even. Prior to ninth grade, I can't even remember who I was. Like, I was nothing. I was I had no identity. I had no ambition. No, like, it's incredible. But that's not entirely true. There's some things I don't admit. I did dabble with computer hacking. That was my way of acting out in middle school.
Got it.
Yeah.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened had that one teacher in not ninth grade anything? Never pulled you aside and said anything?
Yeah, I probably would still be in special ed today. I think it's quite likely that the trajectory I was on would continue for quite a while where I just was not college bound. And not only that, but I probably wouldn't even discover that I had a musical talent. So there were other coincidences things. So once I started to do orchestra, I also overheard the choir singing. Regina Gordon, the choir conductor there, started talking to her and we got along really well. And she's like, "You know what, why don't you join the chamber singers?" And we meet after school. And I just started going to chamber singers, then realized I had a voice, like I could sing. And that was actually my ticket to higher education, because in senior year of high school, I applied to Carnegie Mellon University for the psychology major. And I wrote a personal essay, which I still have saved, about the first question is, what is achievement? You know, what is intelligence? You know, this is a 17-year-old Scott, you know, saying like, we need a new way of thinking about this stuff. And I got rejected from the psychology department. Basically my SAT scores were too low to redefine intelligence. I thought that was the most ironic thing in the world. You know, they're like, "Your personal essay is great and we love your spirit of redefining intelligence, but your SAT scores aren't high enough."
Right. It's like, but this one test is telling us you're not actually smart enough to redefine it.
I thought that was really ironic.
That's so strange.
So I rolled up to Carnegie Mellon to their opera program, because the same school, same university, but their music conservatory, they didn't look at SAT scores as highly as the psychology department. And I went in and I sang my heart out, and they offered me a partial scholarship to Carnegie Mellon. And
for opera.
For opera. Right. So that's how I got in, through the back door.
You know? Was your intention the whole time? Like, that was your...
No, that actually wasn't. I wanted to be a psychology major, and I did want to sing opera, for sure. In fact, I wanted a double major. I think in my heart of hearts, I really wanted to be a double major. Yeah, the psychology program rejected me. So I was full on opera major at Carnegie Mellon for about a year, year and a half, until my heart pounding in my dance tights, because I had just come from dance class, went to the psychology department, and my heart was literally beating. And the secretary was there, and she was on lunch break or whatever, eating a bologna sandwich or something. And I was just like, hey, do you think maybe I could be a minor in psychology here? I just took a course, Intro to Psych, and it was so good. And, you know, it's called Fill in the Door Technique. You start small, thought like a minor would be, and she, it wouldn't be a big deal. And she's like, yeah, whatever. It's no problem to sign this piece of paper. And I just couldn't believe it. Like, I remember and just like skipping in my tights back with this paper in my hand, like, holy cow. Like, I just cheated the system. Like here I am. Like when, if you just show up, if you find a way to show up to a place of high expectations, people stop questioning things, you know, like people give you more opportunities if you just show up. And I think that's why to this day, I'm super sensitive to and want to fight for the underdog or fight for people that we have labeled the totality of their being, you know, in some way.
It's almost like, in a way, you took all your experience and also probably a little bit of your hacking lens.
Maybe. Oh, that's a good point. It's like, I never made that connection before.
It's like you hacked the system. Okay, you're like, I want to go to CMU, but I want to study psychology, but I can't get in that
the
way.
System.
So let me do some social hacking to
get
in there.
I did social hacking. You're right.
Yeah.
You're the first person to make that connection. Yeah.
And it's interesting too, that was always your intention, but
yeah.
What's interesting to me also is that you were willing to play a long game.
I was, yeah. I was really determined to, particularly once I took a course in cognitive psychology my sophomore year, and we had a textbook, and there was a chapter on intelligence. And once I discovered the science of intelligence, there was no turning back. I mean, that was it for me. Like, I had a vague idea that I wanted to do psychology, but I didn't know there was a whole field. It was almost like, in my head, I created this field that already existed, you know, like, and I didn't even know it existed. And then when I learned it, first of all, when I learned it existed, I remember thinking to myself, damn it. You know, like, I wanted to be the one to redefine intelligence. It was funny. I remember thinking, like, wow, this exists. But then I was like, this is the guy I need to study with. So I looked at the front cover of the book, the textbook said it was written by Robert Sternberg, Yale University. And I remember thinking,
he's kind of a legendary guy.
Legendary psychologist. And I was like, well, that's who I'm going to study with in grad school. And I went to the professor of cognitive psychology that I was studying with, Anne Fay. She became a very important mentor of mine. I told her my intention. I said, I would love to go to grad school with Robert. She said, great, let's figure out a plan, a very detailed plan to make that happen. So we did independent readings on intelligence. We had a whole semester where we read every week. We would meet and discuss research on intelligence. I was in the library all the time. I think I read every book in the intelligence section of the library. I was obsessed. I studied with Herb Simon, who was a Nobel Prize laureate, took his graduate level class. And then I spent a whole summer as a unpaid intern in Robert Sternberg's lab at Yale. And he got me in despite my, again, not stellar GRE scores.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you're doing all this, clearly you're deepening your academic knowledge of the field in a huge way, and also simultaneously setting you up for this, again, longer term thing that you're like, I will work, I'll figure out a way, and I'm willing to wait a couple of years and reverse engineer the process to get there. So you're redefining your own sort of cognitive capacity, or redefining the way you look at it. But how, as you are sort of moving through this and building your wisdom, your knowledge, and your chops, how's it changing you as a person and the way that you saw yourself and experienced the world?
Really significantly. Like, I didn't realize how much I loved learning till I was given the opportunity to do so. I really did not realize it. It was something that really struck something deep within me, how much I just enjoyed. I remember I had just stacks upon stacks of binders with papers, scientific papers, especially the semester in independent reading. Anne Fay couldn't keep up with me. Like, she wrote that in her letter of recommendation for me for the Gates Scholarship, because she let me read her letter of recommendation. She's like, literally, I could not keep up with Scott, because he was too excited, you know, like, to learn this stuff. And he would come to me and he would have read two binders worth of stuff on human intelligence. And I was just ravenously curious about this field and about, I wanted to learn everything. I almost felt like I had to catch up, you know, and I didn't realize that. So it really changed my view of myself, because I didn't realize that I loved learning and also that I could learn, you know? So maybe those two went together. Like, once I realized I could learn, also that excited me that I wanted to learn more. I don't know. Maybe it was an interesting cycle.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight-up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Good Life Project is sponsored by LinkedIn Ads. So as a business-to-business marketer, your needs are unique. B2B buying cycles are long, and your customers face incredibly complex decisions. So isn't it time you had a marketing platform built specifically for you? LinkedIn Ads empowers marketers with solutions tailored for B2B. Imagine having direct access to a billion professionals, including 180 million senior executives and 10 million C-level leaders. With LinkedIn's powerful targeting tools built for B2B, you can drive serious results. LinkedIn ads generated 2 to 5 times higher return on ad spend than other social platforms in the technology space. We've actually tapped the power of LinkedIn ads a number of times ourselves, and the campaigns have been really successful. If you're ready to revolutionize your B2B marketing, try LinkedIn ads with a $100 credit on your next campaign. Terms and conditions apply. Go to linkedin.com/goodlifeproject to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/goodlifeproject, or just click the link in the show notes. Terms and conditions apply. I mean, at the same time, it's like you're capable of performing at an exceptionally high level. But I mean, you just threw something else out, which is that here you are. You're in Carnegie Mellon, and you're like a top university. You're in a psychology program studying with incredible people. You're setting yourself up to study with this brilliant person at Yale and achieving at the highest possible levels. And then one of the things to get into a program like Yale, a grad school like Yale, where you eventually do your PhD, as you shared, is you got to take the GRE. You know, so then in the middle of this whole thing, drops this one sort of like, again, old school experience of like, here's a standardized test and you go and take it and don't perform on by that
not
metric.
Yale standards, not right. By Yale standards. I didn't do that bad on the GREs, to be honest. It's not like wasn't as bad as my SATs, but for Yale standards, that might be a Guinness world record there.
I mean, did that rattle you at all, or by that point were you just like, okay, I get what's happening now and I can file it where it needs to be filed?
That's exactly right. I got to the point where I realized that by that point, wow, I can actually I guess, continue to hack things. Yeah, come to think of it. Now I'm framing this in terms of hacking, which I never had before. But I'm like, wow, I think I was like, well, I can, you know, I'm good at this hacking thing. you know, like I got into the psychology department. Maybe I could figure out an alternative. Now, instead of the hacking framing, I had thought of it as like, you know, there's multiple paths. There's multiple routes to get to where you want to go.
Man.
And yeah.
So you end up showing up at Vail and you study, you do your PhD. And again, you're deepening into this whole time, the exploration of, it goes back to that original goal. I want to redefine intelligence, or the way we sort of like look at intelligence. It's a bunch of years back, we actually had Sir Ken Robinson on. And
oh, yeah.
And he threw out a line, which has always stayed with me, is, you know, most people ask the question, you know, like, are you intelligent? He's like, that's not the right question. The question isn't, are you intelligent, but how are you intelligent?
Yeah.
What do you think of that frame?
Interesting. Well, I will say it is totally surreal to headline creativity events with Sir Ken Robinson now. Like I never thought that day would come. And I listened to him talk at these events and think that, oh, this is going to be a very nuanced answer. Are you ready for a really nuanced answer? Earlier in my career, I would have been more excited about things like that, statements like that. For sure, like, you know, like Howard Gardner, who has the theory of multiple intelligences, really, really inspired me in grad school to want to be in this field. And Robert Sternberg, who's a multiple intelligence guy. But I once I started studying intelligence formally, and I knew that if I was going to change the system, I'd have to learn the traditional route. So I took a year off of Yale and went to University of Cambridge, where I, on a Gates Cambridge scholarship, where I studied with a leading British psychometrician, Nicholas McIntosh, studying like traditional IQ. And what I learned from that is that there is such a thing as general intelligence. There's such a thing like IQ, the total score is not meaningless. You know, like it does predict lots of things in on average in the general population. The nerdy side of me is like, you know, like there was this like personal side of me that like really, like if I heard that Sir Ken Robinson quote back in college, again, it would have fired me up. And it's a very firing up statement. But I think that it's also probably not completely scientifically accurate, because I think that while there are lots of different ways to be intelligent, people on average do tend to actually be good at lots of these things, you know, at the same time, you know, like it's not like a complete, you know, ability sort of split. You know, there are people who are really quick learners across the board, you know. So, you know, like the nerdy side of me, like once I started studying traditional intelligence, realized there are both multiple intelligences and a general intelligence, you know, but, you know, you really have to ask, what is the purpose of school, you know? And I think that is that Sir Ken Robinson has done a lot of really important work in kind of framing it that way as not even intelligence. Maybe we can even just go beyond the intelligence framing, you know? Why does everything have to be constantly about the word intelligence, you know?
Yeah.
There are different abilities.
Right. And it's also, I mean, intelligence is a loaded word to a certain extent, right?
Totally loaded.
Because everybody, it's like, I don't ever want to be labeled anything but, you know, and
there's a lot of things that are in life that are more important than intelligence.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and there's so much more research around that now also, but even so, like I would remember, like if I flash back to my law school days, and I was always the back row person in school, and I would kind of coast, but in law school, I was like, I'm doubling down. I want to do the best that I can possibly do. And I worked nonstop, and very often because I worked on the assumption that I am 100% not the smartest person in the room. Whatever blend of nature and nurture got me into this room, you know, I probably shouldn't be here because my grades weren't very good in college. In fact, they were pretty bad. But here's my chance to prove myself, to prove what I'm actually capable of. Still, I was the back row person because I kind of, you know, that was my MO. And I also remember having one friend who basically would blow off the entire semester. He would like kind of touch down every once in a while for a class and sleep through most of it. And then at the end of class, he would end up getting the high score. And the way he did it was that he would, you know, he would beg, borrow, and whatever. He was a lovely guy. So he'd be like, hey, can I take a look at your outline? Or, you know, he would be like trading up for different people's outlines and stuff like that. And then he had what was labeled, I don't know if this is a real phenomenon or not, but what he said was a photographic memory. And he would scan a 100-page document, essentially be able to just recall the entire thing. And he would show up at the room.
Good friend to have.
And he would just nail the whole thing. Yes, on the one hand, good friend to have. The other hand, I'm like, son of a bitch. You know, I'm like, why couldn't I have gotten that brain? Like, and I associated that with this innate intelligence that I didn't and never would have.
Yeah. I mean, aren't there lots of, It's so funny. I bet if we interviewed him, he would like spontaneously say, like, you know, I had this friend John that feels, I just love the way he was just like, he like everyone loved him. Like he was
yeah,
so,
I don't know about
like,
that. He was so, everyone loved yeah. this guy also.
No, but that you have certain social skills, you have certain other cognitive tricks up your sleeve that he doesn't have. I mean, it's just funny how we always think like, you know, the grass is greener just because someone's more different than us. You know, the grass is not greener just because someone has something that you don't have.
No, I totally agree. So you get to a point where you're actually, okay, let me put my flag in the ground in this world of intelligence. And here's my theory, you know, so share a bit about
that. Took a while to actually, because I actually spent many, many years dutifully studying traditional intelligence with the idea that someday I would like to redefine it. But it's not like I immediately hit the ground running and redefined it. That didn't happen until 2013, or actually 2009, when I published my PhD dissertation was a new theory. That was a new theory of intelligence called the dual process theory of intelligence. But leading up to that, that was the culmination of everything. But there was a good, you know, 7-8 years where I just put my head down, didn't tell anyone that I was working with my story, because I didn't want them to think of me any differently. I didn't, you know, when I'm studying traditional, and I heard a lot of discriminatory things from intelligence researchers as I was doing this research, that I had to bite my lower lip, you know, like we would print out data and there would be a scatter plot and there would be like some points, some people whose IQ was about the same level as mine was, you know, when I was tested with a learning disability when I was 7 years old, and they would make comments like, oh, look at those dum-dums on that side of the curve or whatever. And I'm like, I just wanted to be like, mother, you know, like really? So I just kept my mouth shut, kept my head down. And yeah, it wasn't until my PhD dissertation that I decided to redefine intelligence, and I called it the dual process theory. Yeah.
Is there, I know this was your entire dissertation and it was a year's worth of work.
2 volumes.
Is there a simple way that you could sort of share, like, this is the central idea behind your lens on intelligence?
For sure. I can make it very simple. So what dawned on me is that what had been missing from traditional theories of intelligence was about 50% of human cognition, and that's our smart unconscious. So much of these IQ tests put you on the spot and make you cognitively reason things out. But there's a very smart, intuitive system within us that evolved, that was shared with other animals, that, you know, other animals don't have a consciousness like they do, but they can learn things really quickly, especially probabilistic patterns. So I adapted a whole bunch of tasks that were in the cognitive science literature for the purpose of just experimentally studying our unconscious ability to learn patterns and things. And I adapted them for intelligence research and published one of the first papers showing that individual differences in our intuitive capacities, you know, how people differ from each other, was completely uncorrelated or very weakly correlated with differences in IQ. And that was very exciting to me because it suggested to me, wow, there's a whole other world of intelligence within us that we haven't really measured. So I came up with this dual process theory of intelligence where I defined, I'm trying to remember how I defined intelligence in 2009. I think I defined it as the ability to flexibly switch between different modes of thought depending on the task demands. That's how I define intelligence. And I didn't limit it to the conscious mode of thought. You know, I definitely, you know, there's different modes of thought. I also studied something called openness to experience in my dissertation, which led to my research in creativity. But I also suspected that there was some forms of cognition that like artists have and stuff that wasn't being tapped into as well. So that was another major argument in my dissertation, is like, what about artistic cognition? You know, what about, so I studied something called latent inhibition, which is a form of unconscious processing that artists have a very weak latent inhibition, but that had been treated in the literature as only schizophrenics have that, you know, only like crazy people have that. And I was like, well, but a lot of creative people in this literature seem to have it too, right? So isn't there more to this story? So that was another big component of my dissertation as well.
So you said that was how you defined these things in 2009.
That was
10 years ago as we sit here and record this.
Yeah.
How has that changed?
I built on the dual process when I was working on Gifted, Intelligence Redefined, which came out in 2013. So by 2013, I was defining intelligence as the dynamic interplay of ability and engagement in the pursuit of personal goals. It's a mouthful of a definition, but we can unpack it.
Yeah, so let's do that. Tell me more.
Yeah. So intelligence seemed like we couldn't really think of intelligence or the intellectual capacity or potential of a human without taking into account two things in addition to their ability. One is how engaged are they in the task or what we're assessing, and, you know, how enthusiastic or relevant is it to their life? And then, you know, how much is it associated with their personal goals in life? You know, like, so I called it the theory of personal intelligence. So I have the theory of dual process theory of intelligence, and I have the theory of personal intelligence. So those are two theories that I have. These days, I'm much more into the theory of personal intelligence because I think it's more practical for helping to assess. We shouldn't just be about obsessing all the time. It should be about bringing it out, you know, in lots of kids. To do so, we need to really like ask them, not just stick them in a room and give them a completely abstract reasoning task that's divorced from their own life. You know, I feel like we need to engage them in the relevance of the tasks we're asking them to do, and actually ask them what are your dreams, what are your aspirations in life.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting though to bring that into the conversation about intelligence, because that starts to bring in factors that are external to the person. Well, I mean, it's some internal, but also external, but at least it brings in a lot more sort of environmental effect and other people. It's like, it's this bigger ecosystem, whereas so much of the classic understanding of intelligence isn't like, this is you from the inside out. Like this is your brain and it's largely fixed too. You're like, it is what it is. And you can kind of make up for it to a certain extent by like, but kind of more or less is what it is. But the idea of bringing in how engaged are you in the thing that you're doing and how connected to a sense of personal purpose, or, you know, like I really want to strive to understand or make this happen. Those are not two things that I think most people would associate with
intelligence.
Yeah, called intelligence.
And I've gotten that criticism. Trust me. Like that's not something I've heard that a lot. And I think that that's fair enough, but like I never in my book Ungifted, I never disregarded the value of IQ testing. See, I've never been an anti-IQ person. A lot of people put me in that slot because they think I should be, but I'm like, I'm constantly surprising people what I actually think about things. This is the kind of a story of my life as well. You know, people assume, oh, you must think this or that. And it's like, no, actually I have I hold in mind two things that may seem contradictory, and I think they're both true. So I think we can differentiate general intelligence from personal intelligence. And I do that in my book. I think there's people with high general intelligence, but very low personal intelligence, and vice versa. You know, there are people who are very quick learners and they learn things their whole life, but none of the things they learn matter to them or light them up. You know, like you can be a good processing machine and be as depressed as all heck in your life, you know, vice versa. You can not be like super quick to soak up information, but be deeply thoughtful and inspired, realize a vision. You can absolutely be a great leader still, you know, and realize a personal mission.
Yeah. So it's almost like, would it be fair to say that personal intelligence is more connected to flourishing?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see what I'm saying, though, that we can still call it personal intelligence and not invalidate that general intelligence exists.
Right. It's like two things.
Yeah.
Both can be present. One can be present. The other can be present.
Exactly. That's why I kind of, when you gave me that Serkan Robinson thing, it's like I feel like some of this stuff is pitted too much. Is like, it's not this, it's this. And I feel like a lot of people sell books by saying things like that. I think what we need more of in our society is more of and thinking, what they would call improv, yes and. But I think we need more of that in the public discourse. And you see this in politics, you know, you're either a liberal or you're a Republican. And then I constantly shock people, you know, because I say, no, I think that was a good point that Republican made. No, I think that was a bad point that Democrat made. And then sometimes I'll say the opposite because I like taking things on a case by case basis.
No, it's
sorry to get political there for a second.
No, not at all. I mean, and it's interesting that the idea of these sort of like two different types of intelligences, and they're both playing a role and sort of like weaving together and having different outputs into the way that you experience life is really interesting also. And that, you know, if you just automatically say, well, that's not the valid one and I'm going to focus on this, you may get the benefit of this, but it's the sort of compound interest of both that leads to sort of optimal human experience.
I love the way you talk. That was so well put. You know, the subtitle of Ungifted,
which is one of your books, by the way, for those.
One of my books, yeah. Part of the subtitle was The Many Paths to Greatness.
Right.
Yeah. So I really feel like I'd been building up to that.
Yeah.
Subtitle.
Interesting also that your first sort of big thing, you know, the first thing you put out there or a lot of your research, early research, is based around redefining intelligence. But as you mentioned, sort of along the way, you're existing largely in an academic world, which is completely surreal like universe that has its own rules, its own culture.
And I still feel uncomfortable among academics.
Right. But you're also writing things where you're saying, okay, so I'm deep into academic theory. I'm deep into science. I'm deep into validation. And at the same time, I wonder if this is because you have lived this as your own experience, you're also fiercely devoted to, but how does this influence the way that people live on a day-to-day life?
Absolutely. What drives me the most these days is my love of teaching. I feel like that is my problem. No, that is my number one sort of purpose these days, you know, is what lights me up is I get really enthusiastic. I consider myself a teacher in life. Maybe it's not just through my college teaching, but like my blog at Scientific American, for instance. I view that as a form of teaching, you know. What I really like to do is I get enthusiastic about things, and then I want to impart that to people so that they can live a better life, you know. I mean, does that sound familiar? but you know, I created this course, Columbia, that I start teaching on Wednesday called The Science of Living Well. And I'm really excited to think through with the students for what does the science mean for their own individual life. I love it when I get asked the question. I'm on the radio sometimes. They ask me, well, what's the definition of living well? And it's like, give me a break. Like, the definition for you is only you can figure that out.
Yeah, it's so interesting because the last question I always ask everyone here is like, if I offer the phrase to live a good life, what does that mean to you? And so many people have asked me, well, what is it? Like, what is the universal answer to that?
42.
Yeah, and what I've realized now, having asked this to hundreds of people across every domain, every level of performance and achievement, is that in fact, yes, there are some universal themes, but each person's experience of that is going to be very unique to them, and they language it different, and they experience it different, and they focus on something different, and I've had guests that have come back a couple years later. And because they're in a different part, they're not who they were, 4 years before, and they're a different moment in their life, their answer changes. So it's it's a dynamic thing as well.
I love that. It's so true.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lexus GX. So have you ever owned something that inspired you to just up your game? For me, it was this high-end mountain bike. I love the ultralight frame, the suspension, the precision gearing, and I realized it deserved to be ridden to its full potential. So I started training harder so I could experience the joy it could give back to me. And it paid off. That bike helped me discover just new levels of performance and straight up joy. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Imagine tackling rugged landscapes with the available 33-inch all-terrain tires and multi-terrain select, then unwinding with the available front-row massaging seats. This is a vehicle that inspires you to go further, to live up to its full potential. So why settle? Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
The biggest names in tennis are coming to Paris for the most anticipated Roland Garros in years. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled tournament access as the world's top players in tennis face off against each other. Will the veteran champions continue their dominance, or will a fresh face emerge to challenge their legacy on the clay courts? Daily live coverage of this epic showdown begins Monday, May 20th. Don't miss a matchup. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm endlessly fascinated with how people have chosen to spend their short lifespan on this earth. I'm more curious of it than I'm like not judgmental. Maybe I should be more judgmental sometimes, but I just, you know, like people are like, that person was an asshole. And it's like, no, I'm just fascinated with that's like, that's how that person chose to spend their life is maybe arguing with people on Twitter all day, you know, but that's their choice. Sometimes I think we need to have more respect and honor the sacredness of a life, you know, of an existence. I really think there needs to be more sacredness about that and a recognition that you have chosen your life this way, but this other person has chosen to live their life their way. And it's okay if it's completely different than your own thing, but we need to have love and compassion for that route that they did, because, you know, we were all endowed with the same basic structure of the brain. You know, what differs is there's very subtle differences, but that explains all the variation. You know, there's like, we share like 98% of the same DNA with chimpanzees, right? It's like the very small part that is unique, you know, to humans, like causes all the variation we see among humans. And it's that very small variation that somehow causes us to be so different in how we choose to live our lives, but doesn't make one life a better life necessarily than another life. It's just interesting to think, oh, huh. Like I will look at a lot of examples of things with less of a judgmental lens where everyone else will judge, you know, be like, oh, you know, that person, you know, and I just think like, wow, that, you know, what are the factors that really cause that person to be content living that life? It's just, I find it endlessly fascinating, you know?
Yeah. It's almost like everybody is a case study.
Everyone.
But yeah. I mean, and I think we tend to overly, like, I'm raising my hand because I'm human just like everyone else. And I'm probably much less, I'm more closed than you are. I think I'd like to think I'm open, but the truth is I look at people, I'm like, how could you want to live your days so angry, so frustrated? And I'll look at, and I find myself getting frustrated because I'll look at somebody's life and I'll be like, you have privilege, you have resources, you have relationships, you have status. And yet these are the choices that you're making when there are so many people that don't have the benefit of those things. And I think a lot of people get frustrated. Well, if the way somebody else is acting is impinging on your personal freedom, then I can understand that. But that's a different conversation. But I think a lot of people get frustrated because they look at others who they perceive as having so much available to them, and yet they choose to sort of live in a very negative place and contribute from a very negative place and contribute energy that is negative or destructive rather than constructive and additive. And my sense is that's what frustrates a lot of people, me included. And I wish I didn't feel that way. Curious just sort of what your lens on that is.
I mean, that's how they chose to live their life. You know, in some ways, you know, we can have, I on my podcast, I had a great chat with Sharon Salzberg, who I love, about this. This exact conversation we had, and, you know, we can have a loving kindness practice where we recognize that person probably is suffering. Like, you know, if we wish less suffering in the world, you know, we should wish less suffering for that person as well, because it's only going to lead that person to live a better life. And there's a very strong correlation between living a good life and contributing to the world in a positive way. There is a correlation there. I mean, like, there's a science of that. That's not a judgment value call. I'm saying there's a correlation. So the more that we can really help people live a good life, the more we will benefit the world. But, you know, with some people, you really see so clearly their suffering. They're taking out, what they're doing is they're projecting their traumas on the world, and they're not owning up to it within themselves. And you can see that all over the place these days, all over, you know, like anyone who tries to control someone else's life, someone else is living well, you know, in such a tight way to conform to their own rigid or selfish needs, you know. They're clearly that's a form of suffering on their own part, you know?
So, yeah. And I agree. And that's been the lens that I try and take, you know, is what must they have gone through, like, that's led them to this place in their life to be this way in the world? And
it's a good question.
And it's sometimes it's easier to find compassion. Sometimes
that's true.
Sometimes it's not. But I agree that as a practice is I think is a healthy aspiration for all of us.
I don't know. I think I should get angry more than I do. And that's something I'm trying to deal with. I'm not just saying that's a strength of mine and I'm not bragging about it. I'm saying sometimes maybe I should get more angry than I am. But my gut reaction when I see just horrible people is I feel pain for them. Maybe I shouldn't. Maybe I should be you mother. But I feel there's so much more to their potential of their happiness, of their meaning in life, they don't realize.
But I wonder if that's a factor of the way that your brain works, where you see them as a puzzle.
Maybe. That's
and
possible.
You love to deconstruct and figure out what's really
happening. I do like here. Deconstructing, unless there are exceptions. So I'm much more compassionate about those who have internalizing disorders than externalizing disorders. So I am less, I'm not perfect in that sense, that I'll see, if people have externalizing disorders where they really are almost totally deflecting their inner pain to make other people suffer, I do see less of a puzzle, more of that person needs to be stopped from that,
Right. So, and internalizing meaning more it's manifesting in their own suffering versus externalizing.
Yeah.
It's manifesting.
I think I feel more of that automatic feeling when I see. So I see someone with a borderline, my heart goes out to them, because you can clearly see, and that's a great case. Borderline is a case because I've studied that it pretty in depth in the general population. We just call it vulnerable narcissism. People who are so sensitive to rejection that they avoid the world and they avoid any criticism. They're just too delicately sensitive about it because they inside at a deep fundamental level, they think they're not worthy of love. But it sometimes manifests itself in terms of grandiose delusions. I'm actually the best. It's a very paradoxical thing, very paradoxical, but my heart goes out to them big time. We have a little bit of all that in all of us, by the way. So it's just a continuum, but my heart goes out because they're not really hurting, they may hurt others, but they really are mostly limiting them, their own selves, from living a full life.
Yeah. Which kind of sets us up for something else I really want to explore to you. And that's your most recent work, which is this idea of, you'll give me your language for it, but stepping into your potential, understanding stepping into 10, whether you call it flourishing, whether you call it self-actualization, it's the top of Maslow's hierarchy. And I know you've gone deep into what's publicly been seen as Maslow's hierarchy and discovered that there's actually a lot more to that.
There is. There are a lot of misconceptions about the hierarchy of needs, things that Maslow didn't actually say, or he never depicted it as a pyramid.
Oh, no kidding.
No kidding. He did say there was a prepotency of needs, but he never said it was a level, a video game where you get one and then and when you get to the next level, you never go back to the other level. He explicitly said that we're constantly regressing, and he never drew it. Like I said, that was in business textbooks. He started to do that to depict his theory after he passed away, or maybe even the last couple of years of his life, they started doing that. I wish I could have had a conversation with them to see what do you think of that? What do you think of what they're doing there? But there's a lot of other misconceptions. A really quite big misconception is that he thought self-actualization was the pinnacle. He actually didn't. The last couple of years of his life, he really got very much more spiritual and started to view transcendence as more important than self-actualization.
Tell me, how do you distinguish those two things?
Well, you could kind of see self-actualization as bridge to transcendence. So you can see it as, realizing your highest potential, your own, idiosyncratic individual greatest strength. And then it's in the service of making the largest positive impact in the world.
That would be the transcendent part.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't always have to be about impact. So much of it is just about being. So when we reach certain states of consciousness where we are really no longer focused on ourselves, we're really, the flow. I think that when we enter the flow state, we've entered a state of transcendence of a sort, and self-actualization is an important bridge to that, because we're more likely to enter flow if we really are operating at a great match between our highest potentialities and a task that is in front of us.
It's so interesting that you keyed in on the word impact as sort of publicly, when you say you make your highest contribution, people immediately translate to impact on others. And it's funny because I feel, you know, you have the research background behind and you've gone so deep into, I know Maslow's work and I haven't, but my intuitive sense for a long time now, and this is sort of like the way I've been modeling things in my head, is that, you know, we can reach sort of that state in one of two ways. One is, and it's partly is sort of like the what's driving us on a deeper level. You know, there are some of us are driven by some kind of source code that manifests its highest contribution in a way that leads naturally to an outward impact on other people. Whereas other people get to that same place, but it manifests itself in a way where you feel like that thing inside of you is being as fully expressed as it could possibly be expressed.
Right.
And you are, there is no gap between you and,
the world.
And yeah.
Correct. And that's what Maslow called a peak experience.
Oh, that's interesting. And you being that person very often has tremendous impact simply
correct.
Because of what radiates from you.
That's right.
You know, an artist is doing like they're in that place where they're,
that's right.
they're in creating magical things that yeah. other people interact with it. But that's not why you're doing it. It just happens to be like a beautiful side effect.
That's transcendence is, yeah, just by you being who you are in the world
yeah.
is making the world a better place.
Yeah.
It's about being, not doing.
But I think it's interesting because my sense is that there's a morality play here where the thing where it's like you do the thing where there is a clearly delineated path to external impact and people like you, yeah, that is valid contribution. That is you doing the best work. That is you in the transcendence zone. But you do the thing where like you're just an artist and you're doing your absolute best work, you know, where it rises to the level where you lose yourself in the thing and the wall drops between you, the thing, and the world. And, you know, that's not as valid somehow, that's more self-oriented.
That's unfortunate. That's really unfortunate. And that's a big misrepresentation of what Maslow thought about self-actualization as this selfish individualistic pursuit, despite the impact on others. That's not how he viewed it.
Yeah. So you have, I mean, this has also become an area of research for you, recent research.
It has,
so
yes.
Tell me a bit about what you've been up to.
In multiple
that.
Areas, some which will be revealed hopefully someday, if I ever publish this book I'm working on, I hope I will. Can I knock on wood? Another area of research I can talk about right now is that I did go through Maslow's writings and his characteristics of self-actualizing people. And I created scales to, after some pilot testing, I wanted to see which ones held. He posited 17 in his research. And I found that
17 like pieces of the self-actualizing right, characteristics.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he wrote this paper called Self-Actualizing People, which was not based on very good science. It was based on his informal studies of science, of his Brooklyn College students, like famous people that he thought were self-actualized, you know, just basically reading their biography and stuff. So it wasn't systematic. I found 10 characteristics. You know, I eliminated some redundancies and then some others couldn't come up with coherent scales to measure them. But I found a list of 10 that I could reliably measure and that all held together. Yeah, you know, all fed into a higher order. Just like there's general intelligence, I found a general self-actualization.
So essentially, you did research that identified 10 key characteristics of self-actualization.
Yeah.
Can you run through those quickly? I know it's like putting you on the spot. Do you remember all 10?
You know, people should certainly go to selfactualizationtest.com and take the test. And it'll tell them, show them where they are on the various characteristics. But there's things that range from equanimity to acceptance to authenticity to peak experiences. Creative spirit would be another one. Humanitarianism. But it's not really humanitarianism in the sense, and I'm thinking about renaming that actually. It's more like there are two which I'm thinking of relabeling. So it's more about like it's just social interest. We're not saying that it's like you have to like have this dream of being a Gandhi, but it's just like, are you completely devoid of all implications of your work for, you know, like, do you care about humanity at all?
Hmm.
You know?
Invested in some way or another.
In some, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's interesting. So these would be essentially 10 characteristics.
Truth seeking is another one, yeah.
Oh, that's interesting too. So 10 characteristics that are correlated
yes.
in some way, individually.
Yes.
Like each one has its own correlation
yes.
with, in some way, shape, or form, self-actualization.
With self-actualization.
Right?
Yeah.
And self-actualization.
Just like IQ.
Tell me like another, just sort of like a common language word or phrase for self-actualization for anyone who's not kind of familiar with this, or like what is the experience of self-actualization? How does that actually show up in your life if you're self-actualized?
What a great question. Well, it is a very nebulous term. And I mean, there isn't like, I don't have a precise definition. You know, I, like I said earlier, it's like, what makes you the best you in the whole world? You know, like there is something within you that you can literally be the best of in the whole world because you're the only one that has those characters. You're the only one in the world that can develop those potentialities. No one else can, you know, because of your unique constellation of traits. So what is that thing that is deep within you, potential that you want to actualize that will make you the most idiosyncratic, personally significant realization? It doesn't necessarily, like I said, then we can get the transcendence part in there as well. But just the self-actualization part is just having to do with like the individual thing. Because Maslow's, in his hierarchy, he had all these other basic needs. Those are things, though, that evolutionarily we all share with each other. So self-actualization is that need to realize that thing that we don't share with everyone else. Self-actualization is that need, though. We're never fully happy or feel fully fulfilled if we just get our stomach fed, if we just get our esteem needs fed. You constantly hear about people who reach the height of publicly recognized achievement and say, wow, I still feel so deeply unsatisfied. You know, we're always striving for higher ceilings on human nature. And that's what I really loved about Maslow's work and why I think we need to bring it back.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. And also, as you lay this out, what's interesting to me is, so I'm certainly not a scholar, but I've done some work and some research and some reading and some studying in Eastern philosophy and spiritual traditions like Buddhism and yoga. You know, the eight-limb path yoga, especially Ashtanga yoga, with certain moral constraints and offerings and teachings. And what's interesting is like there's an eight-limb path to Ashtanga yoga. You know, and it starts out with very mundane practices designed largely just to take care of your basic functionality needs. And it moves up to these, really, it moves up to these more esoteric mindset-based things. And the ultimate goal, you know, like the final number eight in that path is the Sanskrit word is samadhi, which translates to bliss, which also could be called transcendence. So it's interesting to see the overlay between what you're saying and these traditions.
Huge overlay, and I've tried a project that I'm currently working on. I map all these different words. I have a chart of like they're all saying the same thing.
Oh,
you know,
no
like sati.
Oh,
you
that's
know,
so cool.
And like we're all talking about the same thing at the highest sort of stage of human consciousness. And yeah,
So let me ask you this, and maybe this is kind of like a good come full circle question. Also, you know, you have gone massively down the academic, you know, rabbit hole, down the research.
Is that a good thing?
No, it is. You know, like you're deeply steeped in the world of science, of validation, of, you know, like peer reviewed, of publication, of having other people vet and defending your work. And you've sort of come around increasingly. And you're also deeply steeped in the world of positive psychology, which is, I would almost argue, more outwardly focused on the human condition. It's a bit more applied, I think, than some other fields. And now you're kind of coming to this place where your work is connected to these things where now you're actually mapping and seeing all these overlays with thousands of year old spiritual traditions and paths that don't have any of the scientific validation or anything like this. But it seems like it's all pointing back to a lot of the same stuff.
Right. It's almost like, why do we need any of this science?
Right.
We should just listen to the
wisdom. Because it's funny, because I've often looked at positive psychology and said, well, this is interesting. It's always felt like the scientific validation of Buddhism to me.
Everything seems to be the scientific validation of Buddhism.
these
days, yes. Every sort of new form of therapy these days includes mindfulness, like the ACT approach, you know, like the DBT, like it's all like that needs to be a component of it or else it's not somehow not considered a valid form of therapy. No, it's a very good point. I mean, I have other friends who are writers who write about do self-help stuff, and they see like no value in systematic scientific research, you know, like it's just like there's like this is, but I will say, and I not with you, very much not with you, but with some of these other people who do have this kind of attitude, is I see an awful lot of hubris in them. In that they think they have all the answers, though. What I like about science is that it offers us a lot of humility. It kind of allows me to recognize that I don't know if what I think is true is really true. And it allows me to really look into the evidence and see what does the totality of the evidence suggest. It offers, there's intellectual humility, a mindset of being a scientist. Not saying that all scientists have intellectual humility, but there's a certain way of thinking when you're a scientist that I quite like. And I do see a lot of people in this self-help development space spouting a lot of nonsense. You know, like maybe they should just listen to the Buddha more. Maybe that's a good point that you could make is that, well, maybe it's not they need to learn science more. Maybe they just need to like stop being so hubristic and actually listen to people who got it right, you know, back in the day. But I see a lot of hubris.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, I think my sense is there's a lot of good process out there, but we all, you know, when we start to want to attach our name to it as being something unique and new and this is my thing, I think it's, that's where we get tripped up. And like you said, that happens in the world of science all the time. Yes. You know, it's, and we're seeing
especially
so much of that.
Psychology.
Yeah, a lot of that is really being challenged these days. But I agree. I think fundamentally, you know, there's, you know, the scientific process exists. It starts with a question. And like, and in theory, the ultimate goal is just the truth. It's not proving yourself right. You know, but I think we all get caught up, whether it's in the world of academia and science, whether it's the world of pop psychology or self-help, and even in the world of those spiritual traditions where people want to create like their own, you know, like special sauce modern overlay, they're like, how can I carve out my piece of this where I can put my name on the theory? Like I said, I'm human too, so I'm raising my hand. You know, like there, but I think that is always maybe like that to me is the quest. Like, how can we keep getting back to like what is true? And then, and what is like my things are what is true and what is useful.
Yeah.
You know, it always comes back to that to me.
Well, that's wonderful. It's also wonderful that you're not dismissing the truth is part of your value system. Cause I don't think that's the part, it's not necessarily everyone's value system.
Yeah. But hopefully it'll become more so. And like I said, I'm a human being, so I'm not always in that place.
Gosh,
that's,
of course.
That's my aspiration.
Of course.
There are like massively ego driven trips that I go on like everybody
else.
Oh
my gosh. I would be the first one to join you right there with that.
Yeah,
of course.
So there's so many other things that we could talk about. Maybe at some point down the road, we'll have more conversations, especially once your next, evolution of your work is out there.
I'm going to say when I publish this book,
can
we talk about it?
It will happen, definitely.
A year or so from now.
Because there's a lot more that I know you're sort of sitting on now that once it's out there, we'll circle back on.
Yeah,
I'm so glad we made this happen. So I want to come full circle with that question that I shared. I ask everybody at the end, which is if I offer out the phrase to live a good life to you in this moment, what does that mean?
Yeah, I really thought the Greeks got it right when they talked about eudaimonia, living life in accord with your most authentically felt values and your highest, greatest strengths. To me, that would be a fair definition of living a life well lived.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.